Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I am co-host Michael and today it is time for another news episode. Today we look back on the month of January and discuss key news in institutional blockchain. To this, I am joined by Manuel and Jonas. Hi, guys. Happy to have you.
Hello.
Hi.
So today we're going to first cover a market overview. Then we're going to deep dive into a regulation and policy updates, in particular on the Clarity Act drama in the United States and some US bank charter approvals that have been handed out quite often. Then we're also going to review the status of CBDCs globally, look at stablecoins and tokenized deposits, and also look at the go live or launch of some corporate tokenization platforms out there. Let's dive in and start.
Yeah, and let's start by taking a look on how the total crypto market developed in January, end of month, when we record the session. The crypto market had roughly a $3 trillion US dollar market cap, so very similar to the start of the month. Temporarily, it went up almost 10%, driven by a lot of macro news around tariffs, etc., but lost this profit basically. Again, this holds for crypto in general, also Ethereum, but also Bitcoin. And this is, I mean, kind of interesting because this month has also led to a lot of all-time highs in the precious metal space. So, for example, gold and silver is, I mean, I think we've never seen such a run in the last decade or so, in the last probably not a lot of them in the last century even. So we see that precious metals are rising and rising, but crypto actually is not. So Bitcoin is not. So we see clearly that the market does not, maybe not yet, perceive Bitcoin as a digital gold or a safe haven in times of global turmoil and instabilities. So I think that was a very interesting observation for this month of January.
And this really makes you wonder if that digital gold narrative is still not proven. To me, that was actually totally clear. Bitcoin is digital gold. But yeah, when gold and silver rallied to all-time highs during January, macro uncertainty, Bitcoin and Ethereum actually gave back gains. And that reinforces that crypto still trades as a risk asset, not as a safe haven. And yeah, that's a bit disappointing, isn't it?
Yeah, I was about to say, not the digital gold that many people are talking about. Yeah, let's see.
And you see also kind of the difference between theory, where Bitcoin has all the attributes to be a digital form of gold, but still in practice, at least the market does not perceive it like that. As I said, maybe it never will, maybe just not yet, and we have to be patient. So let's see. And besides that, we had a second very interesting observation this month, kind of a development happening between Bitcoin and Ethereum, namely that since 1 month now, there are more active Ethereum accounts than Bitcoin accounts. And this gap is widening very, very quickly. So a month ago, it was kind of equal. And now we stand with, kind of 960K accounts on Ethereum and 660K accounts on Bitcoin. So a massive gap that is currently widening or has opened in just 1 month. We will also link the respective figure from the blog in the show notes. And on transactions, we also see a very similar movement. So that kind of the 7-day moving average of the transactions on Ethereum is nearing 2.5 million, which is a record high and nearly double of the volume of one year ago. So we have seen a very strong comeback of Ethereum here. And at least we think one key reason are the average gas fees that have dropped significantly, currently to approximately $0.15, so the lowest in the network's recent history. So net, Ethereum has become highly attractive again due to this low gas fee. So people are building, people are developing, people are using it. But also, it's kind of pretty clear that the price has not reacted to this change. Question here again. Yet, or put differently, Ethereum did not outperform Bitcoin, for example, recently, despite this, very bullish fundamental development.
Yeah, since we're so carefully now comparing those two digital assets, my read is that Ethereum is really positioning as the institutional back end, like an operating system of the future of finance. So while Bitcoin really gets the headlines and the ETF flows and the narrative debates, Ethereum is becoming almost like the invisible infrastructure layer for tokenized finance, and the market will eventually price this in, eventually. But right now, it's still trading on vibes and macro correlation, I think.
Yeah, and when looking at some Ethereum charts, so the block, for example, has a selection of Ethereum charts comparing it to Bitcoin, Jonas, as you said, but also even to Solana. It's quite staggering what happened over the last months in the Ethereum ecosystem. So it seems as if Ethereum, and I'm not talking about layer twos, but rather the layer one, really start to scale, right? And provide also scalable throughput. As you say, number of new addresses has been rising quite significantly, the transaction count significantly, but then also the fees, they are even lower than Solana fees now, which is always positioned as the low fee, high throughput, high volume blockchain, right? So it's very interesting. I haven't seen that there were some updates in the last months on the Ethereum mainnet, but for some reason now it really scales. We might need to look into this a bit deeper, what has happened. So very interesting developments here. But yeah, as you say, the price hasn't yet caught up.
And it's also interesting because, let's say, 2 years ago, people have called Ethereum almost dead, as they did so often for Bitcoin. And now we can see, no, it's definitely not dead. Nice. Let's now look into the US. Michael, we had some very interesting movements here as well, primarily on the regulatory side, right?
Exactly. There is some Clarity Act drama going on. So let's dive into what's been happening with the Clarity Act in January. For those who need a quick refresher, the Clarity Act, which is officially the Crypto Legal Accountability Registration and Transparency for Investors Act, is this massive piece of legislation that passed the House back in July with bipartisan support back then. The goal was straightforward. And the regulatory uncertainty that's been plaguing the US crypto industry for years by simply clearly dividing oversight between the SEC and the CFTC. The basic framework is that digital assets intrinsically are tied to blockchain systems, and they would be classified as digital commodities under CFTC jurisdictions, while assets that function more like investment contracts would remain with the SEC. And it's supposed to create this clear pathway for exchanges, brokers, dealers to know which regulator they are dealing with. But here's where January gets interesting. Just hours before a crucial Senate committee markup was scheduled, Coinbase CEO Brian Armstrong publicly withdrew his support. He said on X that this version would be, quote unquote, substantially worse than the status quo, and that he'd rather have no law then a bad law, and the markup got canceled, and suddenly this freight train everyone thought was unstoppable hit the brakes. And I was wondering in the prep what's causing all this friction there, and where there are three main battlegrounds I actually identify. First, you've got this massive fight over stable coins and whether they can pay yield. Traditional banks, I mean, the big ones like Bank of America, are lobbying hard to limit what they're calling deposit flight. And Brian Moynihan, sorry for butchering that name, went on an earnings call saying this would reduce banks' lending capacity and hurt small businesses. The crypto side, represented by people like Standard Chartered's Geoff Kendrick, is saying banks are spending massive amounts lobbying in DC because they know they're in trouble when it comes to competition. Yeah, so that's really the first battleground.
Isn't it interesting to see those battlegrounds now that we've seen in Europe already quite some time ago when electronic money was introduced, now in the US, because the concept of electronic money doesn't exist in the US, right? So for those listeners that might not know, here in Europe since, when was it introduced? I think in 2007, we have a law that allows non-banks to issue money as well, digital money. And there was lots of debate whether they shall be allowed to pay interest. This was clearly neglected, and there's a prohibition of paying interest on whatsoever form, right? So now this rule was used also for regulating stablecoins, and now the same discussions obviously happen in the US. In the US, as we also know, there was lots of loopholes for intermediaries paying yield on stablecoins, even though they are not issuing the stablecoin, right? Which is also not allowed here in Europe. So that's basically the whole discussion. Again, we know this from Europe from quite some time ago already.
Yeah, they're not learning from the mistakes we did. There is a second issue that is around tokenized security. So there was apparently last minute language added to the draft that would make it harder for these assets to get trading permission. Here, Kraken's Jonathan Jackim, for example, called this out as creating unnecessary frictions and distraction. And third, the third battleground is you've got DeFi groups fighting against AML and other control obligations. Of course they are. They are arguing these rules would make it nearly impossible to build truly decentralized systems without centralized oversight, which kind of defeats the purpose of DeFi, right? So totally understandable that the DeFi believers and DeFi builders, like the community around the Bankless podcast, for example, is not amused by the Clarity Act. Now, there's also this competing framework now that emerged from Senator Boozman's Agriculture Committee called the Digital Commodity Intermediaries Act. It's 155 pages now, giving the CFTC primary oversight over spot markets for digital commodities. But it doesn't have democratic support, and Senator Cory Booker specifically cited concerns about CFTC's lack of resources and commissioners, regulatory arbitrage, and this is interesting, quote-unquote, the ongoing corruption of government officials. So that's pretty clearly a shot at the Trump family's crypto interests. So my take here is, I think we're seeing in the States here, or what's actually happening here, is healthy democratic process playing out, even if it's messy. Yeah. So I'm glad to see such a democratic process, even though it's messy. And it's an important piece of regulation because the Genius Act was specifically focused on stablecoins, but the Clarity Act now really seeks to regulate the whole landscape of digital assets and digital currencies. And therefore, the political process, of course, is messy because a lot is at stake.
And I really liked what Manuel said. We had a lot of similar discussions, either like decades ago in Europe, but also with the Mika in Europe. Like, so no new topics, but the feeling I clearly have is that the crypto lobby is just way stronger in the US. Like, I imagine if somebody in Europe would have said this, you know, they wouldn't have been heard, or there wouldn't be moves, right? Like DeFi, no AML requirements or something. That's like a no-brainer, like in Europe, because you have to do it, and the lobby is very, very strong. So I'm really curious to see the outcome of that. Like, if there is really a chance to push this back, also push against some global standards like on AML and KYC, or if this just delayed maybe a little the process.
Yeah, and Michi, I liked what you said. It's a democratic process, right? And we, honestly, I also caught myself thinking about that now in the US with the new administration, everything will be super fast and super quick because, many of the politicians basically just follow the administration's desires. And there is a clear desire from the administration to get this through very quickly because clearly there's also conflicts of interest because of their own businesses, right? But it shows me that there's really resistance now also from other angles that want to find a right way to regulate this new industry, right? It's still very early in the US when it comes to regulation of this new crypto industry. Let's not forget that. In Europe, we have regulatory clarity with MiCA, which is much wider than Genius. And now this Clarity Act aims to provide this clarity as well. It's very early, and the discussions, I feel, have now only really started. So let's see how long it takes. Everybody expected an act or a regulation until summer. Let's see whether that comes. My gut feel, I would totally agree to what you said, is it's good that this discussion comes up, and that there's also now, let's say, a political opposition being formed. We see this in various different areas again, right? That really speaks up against the Republican Party and the strong drive to push things through, whereas it's likely healthy to have this discussion.
Yeah, I remember well that for years in the podcast, we've been complaining about regulation by enforcement, about the lack of clarity from US regulators. Now we're finally getting a comprehensive legislative effort, and surprise, it's complicated and contentious. So that that's simply what happens when you try to regulate a multi-trillion dollar industry with deeply entrenched interests on all sides. It will be interesting to see how this process turns out. Let's just hope that the US really gets a major piece of legislation that can actually be compared to the MiCA regulation in the European Union. Yeah, and with that, let's move to our second piece of news regarding policy and regulation, that is bank charter approvals. So moving to bank charter approvals, this has been a huge development in January. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency in the United States gave conditional approval for national trust bank charters to both Ripple and Circle. And now in early January, World Liberty Financial, which is Trump family backed, announced they are seeking the same type of license. And yeah, let's break down what these are. A national trust bank charter lets you operate across all 50 states without getting separate licenses in each one. You're federally supervised by the OCC, but you're not taking FDIC insured deposits or making traditional loans. These are focused on custody, settlement, and fiduciary services for stablecoin issuers specifically. This means managing reserves and potentially offering institutional custody services. Yeah, and Ripple's getting a charter for Ripple National Trust Bank, which will manage the RLUSD reserves. They are emphasizing this dual layer regulation. They're already supervised by New York DFS at the state level. Now they'll have federal OCC oversight too. They are positioning this as setting quote unquote the highest standard for stablecoin compliance. And RLUSD apparently crossed $1 billion in market cap within its first year. It is being used in Ripple's payment solutions as a collateral by prime brokers. Yeah, and similar stories can be told for Circle. And then there's World Liberty Financial. They filed through a subsidiary that is the World Liberty Financial Holdings. And their stablecoin USD1 apparently reached $3.3 billion in circulation in its first year, which is remarkably fast growth. Zach Witkoff, who's the proposed president, said USD1 grew faster than any stablecoin in history and institutions are already using it for cross-border payments and treasury operations. Yeah, and here's a bit of a controversial part. The American Bankers Association and the Independent Community Bankers of America are protesting these OCC decisions. They are saying this creates a two-tiered banking system where crypto firms get the benefits of a national charter without the obligations of insured banks. And they're concerned about unequal supervision and customer confusion. And the OCC pushed back, saying all applicants go through the same rigorous examination as traditional national banks, and that new entrants are, quote unquote, good for consumers, for the banking sector, and for the economy. So yeah, would be interesting to hear your thoughts if really a two-tiered banking system emerges, and if so, if this is good or bad for any nation state. Yeah.
I mean, in general, I think it's very interesting that these different bank charters exist, right? That you, in this case, really focus on custody and settlement and not necessarily on the FDIC insured deposits or also even loans. And I think that's exactly what those institutions actually also don't want to do, right? So it's all about, you can read it a lot about full reserve banking and that they want to de-risk the monetary system and actually only provide payment services. We don't have that, at least in Germany, and I'm not aware that this exists on a European level either. So either you are a bank or you're not a bank. And if you are a bank, you also actually have to engage in loan business. So that's one take. Very interesting that this exists. And then second of all, I mean, I would agree if they do run through the same rigorous examination as traditional banks to get this, and the regulator allows it, that could create some interesting new competition, right? Especially in the payments and custody business. For stablecoins in general, I think it's good because then they would also become more regulated and then also eventually be connected to the existing payment system. For banks, clearly, I would say this is a big competition, right? But yeah, very interesting to see this different regulation in comparison to Europe, at least.
Yeah, I'm also a big fan of competition, so I would also support that. I think it's not a surprise that we do see this bank charter licenses granted, right? So when Trump's administration was entering, we knew there will be positive signals also for the crypto industry. So for me, this was just a matter of time. And I guess, you know, to judge if this is really like a fair competition, you know, if the banks have some reasons ground to say, hey, it's not fair, right? They get the same as us without the costs or some of the liability things. Of course, you would need to see this in more detail, right? If this is true or not. But we know how this is, that interest groups typically, you know, cry loud in the one and in the other direction. And then maybe you meet somewhere in the middle. So I could imagine that this is also the case here. But of course, you know, one would need to be more in detail to really, you know, evaluate this with more precision.
I think that traditional banks' complaints here are largely overblown. Yes, these trust charters create a different regulatory category than FDIC-insured banks, but that's appropriate given the different business models of these two types of banks. These aren't taking mom and pop deposits, if you will, and making mortgage loans. They are managing reserves for stablecoins and provide institutional custody. So the claim that this creates customer confusion seems more like protectionism than really genuine consumer protection concerns. So my parents wouldn't consider a stablecoin reserve bank as their mortgage loan bank. So yeah, I think those complaints are a bit overblown. All right, then let's move to a different form of money entirely that is not one issued by private institutions, but one by the public sector, more specifically central banks. What's going on there?
Exactly. So we have seen that retail CBDCs, and that's the focus of this kind of block today, are progressing very differently across the globe. So we have seen that some countries have basically terminated their projects recently, like, for example, Norway and some other countries. And we have also seen that some are really pushing it. And there is a very different approach between, for example, the three, you know, kind of key areas in the world, namely China, the USA and the EU. And why are we covering this today? Because there have been major updates for the euro area and for China, which we want to contrast a little. So if we zoom out first where we stand on CBDC for these three kind of areas, it's pretty interesting because with China, there is a clear approach. CBDC, yes. Stablecoin and crypto, no. That's a very clear guidance. For the US, it's CBDC, no. Stablecoin and crypto, yes. So the exact opposite. And for the EU, it's CBDC, stablecoin and crypto, yes. So it's basically three times yes, which is just very, very interesting from the approach we are following here in Europe as well. And in Europe, to start with, we have seen progress on the work on the digital euro. So we are currently in the technical readiness phase, which is about advancing, providing, obviously, as the name says, technical readiness. So see that everything is ready from, you know, the back end. There is market engagement, which is deepened, and the legislative process is supported. And quite remarkably, already last year, it was announced by the Eurosystem that a proof of concept or pilot will be conducted in 2027, with the goal to validate the functional design and also to progress the technical readiness. Why are we sharing this now? Because there have been details on the proof of concept, the pilot, published by the Eurosystem recently, which is named a few specifications. So for example, that this pilot is supposed to start in the second half of 2027 and should go for 12 months. It will be conducted in a controlled Eurosystem environment, but involving real-world transactions, so basically more than a POC. There will also be PSPs involved and merchants and also Eurosystem staff. So what I actually read was that the goal is 15 to 25 merchants and 5 to 10,000 Eurosystem staff members. So it's really a serious pilot and not just, you know, a very small one. But we will also see that the places, the spots are limited. So also for banks. So there will be a process for PSP selection starting in Q1, actually, and a lot of different use cases will be covered. So for example, the DigiEuro can be tested, piloted for P2P use cases, where you can transfer via the app, where you can also transfer via NFC from just tapping your phone. And there will also basically P2B use cases from to businesses, which is about paying with the DigiEuro at a merchant point of sale or soft point of sale terminal and also in the e-commerce. So you see a lot of different use cases are basically part of this pilot. And for me, it was very interesting to see now the pilot being a little bit more specified. Also that the staff size of 5 to 10,000 from the Eurosystem is very serious. Also that banks and merchants will be involved. And of course, as we have a lot of, you know, people from the financial sector here, we wanted to mention that it's also a possibility to participate as a bank, and that this kind of tender to apply will actually also be opened in the very short future.
And what I find interesting about this whole project is that the ECB now really pushes along, right? So it treats the whole project as if it will happen, definitely. And we are not yet there. I want to remind every listener on that, right? So they also say the pilot phase in H2 2027 is contingent to the fact that the regulation, the finalization of the regulation, which shall happen this year in 2026. And that is the basis, that is the foundation. We now saw, for example, also with the other acts that are discussed on the European level, so for example, FIDA, that the trilogue has been spanning across actually several months, if not years. And the trilogue hasn't even started with the digital euro, right? So it's a bold move, I would say. Now also writing out the application phase until Q1, and then also starting the whole build in 2026 to start the testing in H2 2027 under the condition that the regulation will be finalized this year, which is uncertain, I would say, right? So very interesting how strongly they now position themselves in this project to really go ahead.
Yeah, Jonas, I like you bringing this topic again on the agenda, and I like this geopolitical comparison, and the geopolitical competition over digital money is happening right now, and I don't feel that Europe understands this, and Europe is structurally disadvantaged by its governance model. So by the time the digital euro pilot completes in 2028 to 2029, the US will have had years of production stablecoin infrastructure embedded in capital markets, and China will have its ECNY 2.0 deployed across its economy. So the window for European strategic autonomy in digital money is open today, but the ECB's 2027 timeline means it may close before the digital euro is ready. Yeah, and the tokenization platforms we're going to talk about later use dollar stable coins or sterling denominated tokens as the default settlement layer, and the euro losses relevance in the tokenized financial system before the digital euro even launches. So the real risk isn't that the digital euro fails technically. The real risk is that by 2027, the market has already decided which digital money rails to build on, and the euro isn't one of them.
And if we look into China, right, we see it really takes time. So I really would like to contrast this, because with China, we have seen the project started in 2014, the pilot launched in 2020. So this means basically, 7 years then before the pilot launched here. And still, we do see struggles in terms of the adoption there. So there has been some uptake, and the numbers also doesn't look too bad. So in November 2025, for example, there was I think it was for the year, payment processing of $2.3 trillion, which is already, quite some amount. But if you put this into the context of the whole payments, it's not so much. So what happens in China is also that the adoption here is slow undertaking. And for this reason now, they also do conduct a very interesting move to kind of push adoption a little. And this is also what you referred to, Michael, as now coming from ECNY 1.0, which was basically digital cash, to ECNY 2.0. Because what now this shift here is one of the key shifts is that the PBOC, the Central Bank of China, wants to allow banks to pay interest rates on the ECNY, so on the CBDC. It's very important to mention that this does not mean it's an interest-bearing CBDC, so the central bank pays out the interest, but banks are allowed to pay out the interest. And this can, of course, be a tool to incentivize people to hold it, right? Because we know higher interest rates typically mean more attractive to save in it, right? And higher demand. And that's a very interesting shift from what we see across the globe, because everywhere CBDC is perceived as a digital form of payments, right? Not remunerated, just as cash. And China now wants to move more also into the saving vehicle type of thing, right? Which also can have macroeconomic consequences, but could even have cross-border implications if people use this as a means of saving in the very, very far future. So I think a very interesting move, of course, also I wouldn't say desperate, but also a move that really wants to foster adoption. But, I agree what you said, Mike. We are currently seeing a lot of stuff happening in China, which we should monitor very closely. And that was just the retail side. So on the wholesale side, they are working together on the M bridge with a lot of other central banks here and have basically kind of taken over this platform with other central banks from the BIS in 2024. And since then have processed approximately $55 billion in volume, like a 2,500-fold increase from the BIS times before. So what I'm saying here is, this is happening. China is using this very clearly as a strategy for, you know, for their currency to getting this further spread. And there are even discussions from the BRICS countries, we had discussed that before as well, that they also want to connect different CBDC systems. So it's a BRICS priority on their summit, for example, as well on the next one. So net, long monologue. I agree, Michael, what you said. Some kind of a shift is ongoing here. China and the BRICS country really see this as a very important geopolitical topic. And I think we as the EU still have a chance to also play in this field. But I also think we need a clear strategy on cross-currency use here and how we want to position the euro in this, you know, future of digital currencies, because we have a gap because the dollar clearly is losing in importance. And then we can see if this is China and the BRICS countries taking over, or if we as Europeans, as the euro, could maybe take some of this share over as well.
Yeah, what you described about China underscores its scale advantage. So China has been testing since 2014, piloted since 2020, and processed $2.3 trillion by November 2025. And when they now flip the switch on ECNY 2.0 and expand the bank participation, they'll have the most advanced CBDC infrastructure, at least globally, not talking about adoption necessarily, but yes, it's a closed state-controlled system. Maybe that's the European opportunity to keep it an open, non-state-controlled system. So there is the competitive advantage for Europe open if now used with speed.
I mean, I would highlight one caveat though. With regards also, Michi, what you said on all the different forms of money that we see emerging, and they're all different use cases though, right? So stablecoins in the US is at the moment really also how I see it, ensuring that the US dollar is used around the world. And it's very easy to spread stablecoins given the bearer instrument nature of it, right? And actually also maybe exporting the US debt into the world and allowing US dollar access, and therefore indirectly also allowing access to US debt. That's one piece. The other one is dominance or breaking the dominance of private sector forms of money and payment systems, right? And this is clearly the motivation of the PBOC in China, given that WeChat Pay and Alipay is heavily used for domestic transfers, right? And this is what they focus on. Actually, the ECB is focusing on a similar thing, but not necessarily due to simply private money and private payment systems, but rather non-European ones, right? So it's really a sovereignty play with the digital euro. And there's no aspiration at the moment, at least from the ECB, next to Project Agora, you could argue, to engage in more efficient cross-border payments and use of the digital euro, of the euro in general, which the PBOC clearly has their ambition with Mbridge, right? So it's a mix of different use cases that we're seeing. I wouldn't necessarily see the digital euro as an answer to stablecoins, because it's really targeting other use cases, which stablecoins at the moment, at least in the US, are also not positioned for strategically. There's definitely some projects or the ideas or aspirations to make, for example, also domestic transfers more efficiently and cheaper, because card rails are quite expensive in the US, right? But what I see is a big focus in exporting the US dollar, which is the digital euro doesn't even try to, right? I think there's a variety of reasons why all the central banks and the private sector is looking into digitizing money.
So Manu, you don't assume that by 2027 or 2028, there is this one global rail for digital money to operate on, which is kind of the promise of our whole community, like 24/7 global infrastructure on which digital money can operate. What you're saying is we are now, again, at least in those three geopolitical domains, US, Europe, China, build our own islands.
Yeah, I mean, what we see with digitizing money is the fragmentation actually increases at the moment, right? So if every central banks or private sector participants that issue digital money issued on the same network, on the same blockchain, yes, we would have that not happening, but this is not the case, right? So we see Enbridge, which is also super political, right? In the non-Western economies, then the answer with Agora, and I'm going to come to that in a minute, from the Western world or the Western hemisphere. And then we have particular domestically focused projects like the digital yuan and also the digital euro, which doesn't even really exist in the US because, well, they have their card rails. But the fragmentation, I would say, rather increases instead of decreases.
And I'm a little bit puzzled, really, why this digital money topic in general is not a topic of higher strategic relevance for the EU generally, because we do see that China is, again, really seeing this as a tool to maximize impact globally, right? And we do see the digital euro, it's about sovereignty, it's about becoming independent. And I think that the strategy the Chinese is executing is so logical on the wholesale side with Enbridge, for example. And I'm really a little bit puzzled. We are having so much great work happening on the wholesale CBDC side of the ECB, and so many things are going into the right direction. Why not this topic of digital money and fostering the role of the euro with digital money? And this can be stable coins, wholesale CBDC, even retail CBDC. Why this has not more prominence, within European policy making or European thinking? But let's see. I'm often hoping that, with mentioning also this in the podcast and discussing with policymakers, that this may change one day. So hopefully it does. But we clearly see that's happening in China in real time. And I think we have to, we have to do something as well if we are not, want to come out of this as a suffering party, let's say.
Yeah. And yet again, I really like that you brought the topic on the agenda, Jonas, because really global divergence is the story here, isn't it? We're witnessing a fundamental divergence, if not even a split, in how major economies view digital money. And at the moment, this is defining the next decade or so of monetary sovereignty. And China versus USA versus EU represent three actually incompatible visions at the moment. So in China, CBDC is rather a state surveillance and control infrastructure. In the US, the USA is about outright rejection. So stablecoin, yes, CBDC, no. CBDC, no, there is bipartisan consensus. And the US strategy is corporate issued dollar stablecoins to promote US dollar in the world. And the EU is trying to really thread the needle, stablecoin and crypto, yes, but with digital euro as fallback. Yeah, it's a fascinating point in time how this global divergence plays out and which major economy uses digital money to what end.
Yeah, and I mean, the next part in this digital money evolution is also tokenized deposits and stablecoins. I mean, we've talked a lot about stablecoins already, but tokenized deposits also continue to emerge. And let me give you a very quick rundown about the news of the last month in this space as well. So Lloyds Banking Group, for example, in the UK also now issued a tokenized deposit on a public blockchain, which is Canton. Well, many would argue, is it now a real public blockchain? You can argue it is, right? It's a public permissioned infrastructure with permissioned validators. And what Lloyds has done, they used that ledger as the underlying ledger to issue, transfer, and then also redeem those tokenized deposits. And Archax, they basically bought a tokenized gilt and settled that transaction with tokenized deposits. And they moved the funds back into the regular Lloyds account after the settlement, and then also showcased how easily you can on and off ramp, so to say, into these tokenized deposits. So quite interesting that this is now also continuing on public infrastructure. We are seeing the same with JP Morgan issuing on Base and on Canton as well. I do expect that this is going to continue, that not only private permission networks are used for tokenized deposits, but now also public permissioned networks. And on the private permission side, there was another headline of BNY Mellon now also continuing its journey on issuing and releasing tokenized deposits, however, here again on a private permission network. Yeah? So similar to how JP Morgan, Citi, HSBC, UBS, and now even now BNY has, that similar to those banks, they created their own, let's say, core banking system on a blockchain, you could argue, right? So it's a deposit record keeping system that runs on blockchains. And they hope to increase the efficiency through that, allow real-time cash movements, reduce settlement frictions, and allow for 24/7 availability. Yeah? But again, very different to now issuing on a public chain where other participants can even plug in, because this is really a BNY Mellon blockchain. And what these bank-centric blockchain networks all have in common is that they are not really interoperable at the moment, right? Especially because there's a missing settlement connectivity.
And the fragmentation again.
Yes, exactly, the fragmentation again. And what is required in order to resolve this fragmentation is the settlement, which actually Project Agora aims to solve, right? And there was an interesting headline now. Finally, I think the first headline in public that talked about the current progress of Project Agora. And a Reuters article said that it does continue with testing the infrastructure. Again, what is this Project Agora? It's the Bank for International Settlement and the International Institute of Finance, together with 7 central banks and more than 40 commercial banks. Central banks are the New York Fed, from the Bank de France, Korea, Mexico, Japan, Switzerland, UK, they're all involved. And it's really about creating a system for correspondent banking, so meaning not using stablecoins as a new form of money, but rather tokenizing the nostro accounts that banks hold with each other, and therefore creating a more efficient cross-border payment system, including settlement and central bank money. Yeah? And this is a huge endeavor. Let's not underestimate that. If you have 7 central banks and 40-plus commercial banks sitting on the table, yes, you can design a lot. But the question then clearly is, how quickly can this project move? And it was now announced that this new phase is now the testing phase, and that they aim to run tests in the summer in this new 6-month phase. And then also will issue a report afterwards to express how this whole project will continue.
Yeah, what's interesting out the 3 news you brought is that Lloyds and BNY are building internal infrastructure that will be useful when interoperability exists, but neither is solving the very interoperability problem you lined out. Agora is the only project that could actually make tokenized deposits work across banks by including central bank money as the settlement bridge. And so if Agora launches post-testing in 2024 to 2025, the entire private bank blockchain ecosystem, if you will, that is BNY, JP Morgan, HSBC, Lloyds, suddenly becomes interoperable and useful. If Agora, however, stalls or gets watered down to another SWIFT upgrade, tokenized deposits remain isolated internal experiments. So the next 6 to 12 months of Agora testing will determine if tokenized finance really becomes real or remains a collection of incompatible bank demos. Let's hope it succeeds.
Yeah, and I would even be a bit more cautious, because a test transaction and a pilot transaction is not yet a live system, right? So how I see it, in this testing phase, it will be shown that the infrastructure will work, right? It's also not going to be a deeply integrated solution in each of the different banks. That's much more complex. And then the question is, will the central banks actually then also continue with this trajectory to build this system, right? Because usually the BIS is not an operator of any such financial market infrastructure. We've seen it with Enbridge as well. Then the PBOC actually stepped in and now took over the lead for running the system. Somebody would also need to do that. So likely an FMI, financial market infrastructure, would need to be built. So it's still a long journey, I would say. And contrasting that clearly are stablecoins. And let me wrap a couple of news up in the stablecoin space as well. Why contrasting? Well, it's a para instrument that can be moved from wallet to wallet without intermediaries and without the need for settlement and central bank money, because what the transfer of the stablecoin ultimately settles the transaction. So SocGen Forge, so Société Générale, the big French bank, has a subsidiary Forge, which does all the crypto and blockchain business. They have their Euro CV stablecoin, and they have now engaged another interoperability pilot with Swift, where it was shown that the stablecoin, but also traditional fiat rails, could be used to settle tokenized securities. So a tokenized bond was settled on a blockchain, and then Euro CV, the Euro stablecoin from SocGen Forge, but also traditional payment rails were used. So what was shown basically here is that Swift can also be used with their ISO 20022 standard to settle transactions across stablecoins, which typically don't run on this standard. So that was quite an interesting pilot to show the interoperability here. Then another news was, and this is quite big, I think, that Interactive Brokers, which is a company that runs infrastructure for brokerage accounts across many, many different countries, actually in 170 global markets they're active, that the clients can actually now use stablecoins to fund their account. So it's not necessarily that stablecoins are used for the settlement of the securities via Interactive Brokers, but rather you can fund your account with a stablecoin on a 24/7 basis and then receive your US dollars, for example, in your traditional brokerage account. Yeah, so it automatically converts the US dollars into US dollars on your brokerage account, where you can then use this liquidity to trade. Interactive brokers do not charge a fee for that. It's also quite interesting. But Zero Hash, which provides the wallet infrastructure, they apply a conversion fee of 0.3% per deposit with a minimum fee of $1. So it doesn't come for free. But still, I think it's quite interesting to be able to fund your account instantly and 24/7 if you want to trade, because sometimes the balance might not be enough, and then you would, especially in the US, have to engage in a wire transfer, which takes a little bit of time. We are not in the US there, in many other countries as well, similar to Europe, where we have SEPA Instant, which can now process these transactions in a matter of seconds with unlimited quantity. So yeah, very interesting move. And two other updates very quickly. Barclays invests in Ubix. So Ubix is a project we've already discussed here on the podcast platform quite extensively. We even invited Tony McLaughlin and had a chat about Ubix. It's basically this idea of building a clearing network for many different stablecoins, such that the bank that wants to credit the funds into a bank account and therefore off-ramp for a client can very easily clear those transactions and receive the underlying liquidity from the issuer. And Barclays really believes in this vision and now invested into Ubix. It's undisclosed how much it was invested, but definitely an interesting move. And congrats to Tony McLaughlin here on the first institutional investor in its endeavor, next to the rather crypto-focused VCs that so far have invested, which was also quite impressive. And then the last news in general on stablecoin, also quite interesting, that Visa now partners with BVNK for stablecoin payouts. So Visa Direct is a protocol of Visa that allows payments into cards, but also into accounts, and now also into wallets, and therefore allows very efficient cross-border retail flows, SME flows that are transactioned via Visa Direct, 24/7 cross-border into wallets, and therefore basically routing stablecoin transactions or via the Visa Direct network directly from the sender to the beneficiary in stablecoin. So huge adoption play, and I think a great deal also for BVNK, where Visa is also invested in.
And it's interesting that still after so many years, missing infrastructure puzzle pieces are figured out, right? So you mentioned the stablecoin funding account, mentioned the payouts, we often talked about on and off ramps as well, right? So it's very interesting that this is still happening. And I mean, we started this podcast so many years ago, that's still not exactly clear where the future is heading in terms of CBDC, stablecoins, tokenized deposits, crypto for every of the four some interest groups may say this is the future and the other one, you know, are not good for whatever reasons, but we are still in a situation that we don't know. I mean, makes it also excited, I think, for us in our daily work, but still also a lot of uncertainty on how the future on digital money will look like.
Yeah, and the news you brought, Manu, really underscore that stable coins are crossing the chasm from crypto infrastructure so far to traditional finance payment rails last year and this year. So with the SWIFT integration, that is Société Générale Forge, you have interoperability between tokenized assets and existing payment systems. Then you have retail brokerage funding, that is the IBKR news you brought. Stablecoins has 24/7 cross-border funding rails for traditional finance accounts. You have bank investments, that is the Barclays and Ubix news you brought. So banks now accepting stablecoin settlement is inevitable, even still fragmented. So to me, the pattern here is stablecoins aren't replacing traditional finance. Stablecoins really become embedded as faster settlement and payout rails within existing financial infrastructures. I think that's no news by now anymore. And when Interactive Brokers treats USDC like ACH and Visa treat stablecoin payouts like another direct payment option, stablecoins have become plumbing, which is exactly where they create the most value. But this fragmentation risk we talk about remains. So bank consortium stablecoins versus Circle versus PayPal versus Ripple. But SWIFT's orchestration role and multi-stablecoin support from platforms like IBKR suggests to me interoperability will be solved at the application layer, even if the underlying stablecoin landscape remains fragmented.
I mean, these were the positive news about stablecoins or the adoption news. Looking at the time, let me only very quickly highlight that there were quite interesting news around Tether now, that Iran apparently also funded many of their So even the central bank of Iran acquired Tether and funded much of their currency management here to try to stabilize the Iranian currency. Elliptic has published a report and saying that Iran's groups have really worked together with the national cryptocurrency exchange to acquire those stablecoins and fund state-run business with Tether. That's not necessarily great news for adoption of Tether here. And the same happens in Venezuela, where there was news that a lot of the oil business was actually settled in Tether, in stablecoins. So almost 80% of the oil revenue apparently is collected in Tether. And now that many of the wallets that hold those balances have been frozen. So there's still lots of controversy around Tether. Again, this is not the highest regulated form of stablecoin, so likely not the one that would be used for any of the use cases that we have discussed so far in the stablecoin part here in this podcast. But yeah, quickly highlighting here again that there's still lots of misuse of stablecoins and actually also illicit transactions that are processed in Tether here.
But kind of, Manuel, in favor of Tether, even if I'm not a big fan, then I also launched or want to launch this compliant US dollar stablecoin according to Genius and everything, right? So they somehow want to also play at least a little bit in the regulated domain. So yeah, I think that was also quite interesting.
With USAT trying to build a separate stablecoin. Let's see.
Yeah, it feels like stablecoins have become or are becoming a de facto sanctions evasion tool for restricted regimes. Iran's central bank acquired 500 million plus in USDT to support its currency amid rail collapse, while Venezuela collects about 80% of oil revenue in Tether to bypass banking sanctions. And Tether's 182 million wallet freeze, which, by the way, is the largest in its history, is targeting Venezuelan trade, which shows the cat and mouse game between illicit use and enforcement. But the scale proves stablecoins function as effective dollar proxies where traditional currency access is blocked. And meanwhile, Tether is bifurcating. USDT remains the unregulated cash-like global stablecoin, including for sanctioned actors, while new USA product targets compliant institutional domestic use with federal regulation, OCC oversight, and bank rate custody. So the geopolitical reality is that stablecoins provide actual dollar access to sanctioned economies, making them simultaneously valuable for sanctions evasion and creating enforcement choke points when issuers cooperate with authorities. So I'm glad you also brought this more questionable stablecoin news.
Yeah, and looking at the time, we have quickly progressed now this time. Michi, why don't you provide us with a very quick overview on the tokenization platform news that we also saw?
Yeah, let's keep it short. Three major financial market operators launched production-ready tokenization platforms within 5 days in January. This is now really live infrastructure launches. That's not pilot projects. And yet again, we see here a shift from experimentation to deployment. The three ones I'm talking about is the Intercontinental Exchange, which is a New York Stock Exchange parent, building a platform for 24/7 tokenized securities trading. Then there is the LSEG Digital Settlement House, or DISH. It's an interoperability infrastructure enabling instant settlement between independent payment networks. And third, there is the State Street Digital Asset Platform, which launched on January 15th. So the same day as the previously mentioned LSEG platform, State Street custodies 46 trillion in assets. And this is really rewiring global finance here. My take on the relevance of this is infrastructure layer is really being built. Financial systems base layer is being rebuilt by those incumbent institutions. It's not disrupted by startups, which many of us expected as this new industry emerged. And the timing of the three announcements within 5 days suggests that there was some kind of coordination and parallel regulatory conversations going on. But it suggests, we don't know. Yeah, and the industry here really shifts from asking, should we, to how fast can we deploy now? I really enjoy that we see those three go lives of corporate tokenization platforms. Yeah, so the bottom line is January 2026, institutional crypto became really institutional finance. No speculative tokens anymore, but blockchain infrastructure powering core traditional finance, talking about equities, deposits, settlement, and these three platforms I just mentioned are the infrastructure layer potentially for the next 20 years of capital markets to be run on.
Yeah, what I find interesting in all these news is that, as you say, it's traditional players now building their own digital asset layer, or actually also using, in this case, Canton again with LSEC. What I find interesting is that I haven't dive deep now into the way they propose settlement, but the cashlek is still missing, right? So will they use stable coins or will they go for tokenized deposit? That differs to each of the different platforms. But then the other one is as well, how the management of the transaction or the trade actually happens. So we know from DeFi protocols that many use automated market makers and fully automize the trading process, but in a very different way how usually markets are operated with limit order books and so forth. And here these platforms, I'm quite sure, will not necessarily go into a fully decentralized DeFi settlement, right? But rather still run maybe even the order book off-chain and then only settle on-chain when the order has been managed. So it's an interesting mix of how much of blockchain technology will actually be used above the settlement layer, right? That would be quite interesting to compare those. Maybe we should look into this or even invite an expert on that, because it's very different to what we see on public permissionless infrastructure in DeFi, right?
And I think a very relevant move from the infrastructure side, because we need this platform so that things can be tokenized. And we also need platforms that these things can be traded, right? Because that's both stuff that we are lacking, which we clearly need until we have this mainstream adoption. So I'm very happy, Michael, that 2026 started with this with these announcements and this progress here on the marketplace side. And
Go lives, not announcements.
That's what the industry needs. Not talking, doing, that's what you like. So yeah, let's see what 2026 brings here.
Gentlemen, let's wrap it up and share our knowledge bites. Jonas, do you want to start?
Yes, I brought a letter. I wouldn't have seen me saying this, that I bring a letter to this, but it's an open letter by 70 European academics to the European Parliament. And they urge the members of the parliaments to back a strong digital euro. And this includes economists such as Thomas Piketty. And just to quote maybe one key statement out of this is that the academics say, we are deeply concerned that political negotiations risk hollowing out the digital euro project. So they want the politicians to speed up, to bring the legislation to the finish line so that the digital euro is not losing a lot of time and can enter the market in, you know, a not too late fashion.
Nice one. Glad they wrote this letter. I'm yet to read it. I brought a opinion piece by Christian Catalini, co-founder and chief strategy officer of Lightspark and founder of the MIT Crypto Economics Lab and research scientist at MIT. His opinion piece is called The $1 trillion Battle for Money's Operating System. It was published in the Korea Herald later in November, and there are interesting key messages, such as two competing models are emerging. There are the closed corporate chain systems like MasterCard, Zero Hash, Stripe, Tempo, and Circle Arc, where institutions become tenants, risking platform lock-in, versus a more open permissionless networks like Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, where institutions are architects owning customer relationships and innovation freedom. Yeah, so I really liked his framing and this article about the battle for money's operating system in the future. This is a must read from my opinion, on my perspective.
Yeah, and I brought an article from the Atlantic Council on the Chinese ambitions with digital money. So we've already talked about it in the podcast, but this article summarizes quite well the latest figures of the ECNY, but then also provides more update on Enbridge, where also not a lot, at least in the Western media, is being published. So highly recommended if you want to understand better what is happening in China with regards to digital money.
Boom, good stuff.
Yeah, so let's wrap things up now, finally. So thanks a lot, dear listener, for listening to this episode. Make it to the end of the episode. Thanks, Michi and Jonas, for your insights now over the last month. Again, let's see each other next month again for the next news. And yeah, if you enjoy the podcast, recommend and rate us. That helps us the most. Connect us on LinkedIn, where we always post also our latest episodes and try to spark the discussion, but also join our Telegram groups. We have the links in the show notes. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to it. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies to the world. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.